and later, when I find out where she lives, by walking past her house 4 to 5 times a day, with my brow knitted in concentration, maybe anger, as I have convinced myself that I am at my most dashing when my brow is knitted in a Douglas Fairbanks manner, the knitted brow being my fallback position on dashing after several days of concentrated pencil-thin mustache growing ends in despair. Anyway, at the time, we live about a mile outside of Boise, down a little cul-de-sac off Marston Road, and Molly lives in a big white house, halfway into town on the same road. So I have to do quite some walking to pass by her house repeatedly, and the only place my mother allows me to go, unless she sends me to the store for this or that, is the library. So in hopes of being spotted by Molly Warner, I construct emergencies of a literary nature that can only be solved by a new book, which very much delights my mother, the English teacher, who is quite busy taking care of my father, 2 brothers and 1 sister, all while teaching English and preparing for the Great Depression, which is nigh upon us. Well, on none of my many, many walks do I ever spot the magical Molly, but I'm sure that from behind closed curtains she sees me, and my brow, as tightly knitted as a store-bought sweater, and I'm more than somewhat convinced that she has spurned me and broken my heart, although I have not worked up the nerve to even talk to her. But in the meantime, I have read through all the cowboy, pirate, and jungle boy novels the library has to offer in my reading level, and have, in fact, progressed to reading all the novels of Mr. Mark Twain, Mr. Jack London, Mr. Edgar Rice Burroughs, and beyond, until by the time my heart is sorely broken, I am able to comment upon Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, while shooting marbles and catching frogs, which enriches those activities not at all. Anyway, 3rd grade passes into 4th, and I have developed into a brilliant and melancholy little guy. And while I am still slow to screw up my courage to approach Molly, I am sure the next day will always be the day I will say something, and she will fall into my arms, and we will go off to live in the jungle together in a treehouse, with just the apes and the elephants and maybe the occasional leopard, which I will kill with a knife to impress her. But one day, in the summer, as I am making an extra trip to the library, I see a moving van outside her house, and before I am able to say anything, she is gone. Moved away. Forever. One more day and I would have said something. The next time I saw her, I am certain I would have. I am still certain. Which is exactly how I now feel as I walk past the 5 and dime, and don't so much as pause to look at the keychains, let alone ask after Stilton. And then I realize why Eddie Mushu sends me this message. He thinks that Stilton is my Lois Fong, and although there is little reason, beyond her being easy on the eyes and exhibiting no little moxie, for me to have designs on the cheese, I am hooked, caught, doomed. In short, he thinks I am a sap just like him. And I am. But the next time I see her, if I see her, I will not let her get away. The next time for sure. Well, perhaps I will join the seminary. After the Molly Warner catastrophe, I contemplated becoming a monk, and even wrote to a seminary in Chicago to ask them to take me to live a quiet life of spiritual despair. But I never heard from them, the bums. "Thog pizza," said Sal first thing when I walked in. He was wearing a black apron, a bow tie, and a white shirt with garters on the sleeves, looking like the type of bartender who gets shot in westerns. Sal's is the kind of joint where when you open the door in the afternoon, everyone looks up like rats caught in a spotlight eating the brains of a friend dead in a trap. No one is happy to be caught in a bar at 4 in the afternoon. Even the old Elkies who migrate through the neighborhood in the morning to meet a shot already set up for them when Sal opens are a little ashamed. They growl at the light like Frankenstein at fire. Sal wiped down the bar with a tattered rag, like he was mopping up blood from a fresh axe murder. Listless, like he knew he was just stirring the gore on the surface. I cleaned up when he left. "Dog pizza?" I said. It sounded like something Mushu's might bring up, trying to throw me a curve. "Yeah, my people have been eating dog pizza for 1,000 years. It makes your willy wag like a puppy's tail. Try a slice." Fucking Mushu's. "Have I mentioned that my people are from Napoli?" asked Sal. "He might have. Only about 8,000 fucking times." "Well," said Sal, It is a well-known fact that pizza is invented in Naples as well as pasta.
And the douchebag, I said.
Really? I never hear that, said Sal.
Yeah, said I, spinning up the engines. In fact, when Leonardo da Vinci is in Naples, he does the first early drawings of the douchebag. Naples is to douchebags what Kitty Hawk is to airplanes.
Ah. Well, I did not know that. But from now on, I will add it to my story. Anyway, perhaps you have noticed that since the war, with all the guys coming home and getting married and trying to raise families, and with all the apartments in a city filled with citizens who come here to work in munitions factories and shipyards, new houses with yards are being built out in the Sunset District for these new families. So suddenly, there is a preponderance of pets in the city.
A preponderance?
Yeah, it means a shitload. Anyways, when I'm at the store picking up coffee for me and the old lady, I notice that a guy can not only buy several kinds of dog and cat food, but also pet snacks like doggy donuts and kitty crullers.
You don't say, I said.
And then I am thinking maybe if a guy can get an angle on that market, there is a sizable fortune to be made. So first, I think, I am an expert in procuring and distributing certain beverages, so I think that perhaps a line of dog and cat spirits might work.
But no, I guessed. Sal made the money to buy the bar during Prohibition, procuring and distributing certain beverages for very high profit, due to their illegal nature. And since repeal, he'd been searching for a new angle on that business. During the war, he did quite well for himself by watering drinks and selling servicemen liquor at very steep markup during off-limits and curfew hours. But since the Japs surrendered, business declined more than somewhat.
It turns out that dogs and cats do not care for liquor at all, but prefer licking their own balls to even the best bourbon.
You do this experiment yourself? I asked. I was checking my back bar and my kegs before I started my shift. As usual, Sal had restocked nothing at all.
There are some dogs who sometimes frequent the trash barrels out back, and I put a saucer down with some prime Kentucky goof juice to draw them in. But they stay away at some distance, variously scratching and licking their private parts with great enthusiasm. So, I am thinking, perhaps they need to have a taste first. Then they will take to drinking, so to draw them in, I grab a piece of pizza left over from my lunch, which I pick up in Napolitano's down the street. And soon they are all gathered around, quite interested, as I tear off pieces of pizza and toss some to each mutt in turn. But even when I shove one's nose into the bourbon, the mutt is not interested. Then it comes to me, what I am missing the point of, even if it is right there in my face.
Here he paused for dramatic effect. And I, as has often been the case, did not shut up, as would have been prudent. You tasted dog balls to see why they were so delicious? Sal scowled at me as he said,
No, smartass. I realized that what I need to do is make pizzas just for dogs, little ones. Put them in boxes and sell them to all the new families with their new dogs all over the new suburbs.
Well, it sounds as if you found your angle, boss, I said. Dog pizza in a box. Can't miss.
I was thinking Sal's dog pizza, said Sal. But it doesn't have a ring like doggy donuts or kitty crullers.
I could work on the name for you, I offered. Now I just wanted Sal to get out of the saloon so my afternoon regulars would come in. I could see a few had peeked in only to take a walk when they saw Sal still around. I wrote a lot of poems when I was a kid.
Nah, I'll figure it, said Sal. I need you to work on that other thing for the general.
About that, I said. I am not sure how, exactly, to go about such a task of finding a whole gaggle of young single dames who will want to keep the company of rich old guys up in the Redwoods.
Well, he will offer them plenty of cheddar, is how, said Sal. The general assures me this is no problem.
But why does he not just hire professionals?
Because muckety-muck such as belong to the Bohemian Club wish to be appreciated for their charm and dignity and whatnot, and do not wish to feel that they have to stoop to paying for some tale. And furthermore, the general, who has worked himself up from being a grunt airman in the Army Air Corps
after commanding a base somewhere in the middle of New Mexico, wishes to become a Bohemian, which he can only do if they invite him. And despite his rank and his medals, they do not. So he wants the Bohemians to owe him a favor.
I see, I said, which I saw last night after overhearing them. Although I do not see why a guy who has worked his way up to being a general cares about being in a club that does not want him, unless that is the reason itself. The Bohemians were a fixture in San Francisco for quite a long time, and there was no little mystery about what went on at their camp up in the Redwoods a couple of hours north of the city. But rumor was that very powerful guys from all walks of life gathered there to come up with some very influential capers having to do with running the world, such as the Manhattan Project and the New Deal and whatnot. It seemed that they had as members most of the last dozen or so presidents, as well as captains of industry, and the odd artist or writer which they kept around so their name wasn't completely phony. But why guys with that kind of weight cannot procure their own female company, I cannot figure. How does this task fall to you? I asked.
It falls in my lap by sheer luck, said Sal. Last night, Tony Cannelloni, who was a legacy member, invites me into the city branch of the club on Taylor Street. In the 20s, I get liquor for the club, so I am well regarded by one and all. So, we are in there smoking cigars, and it is all very leather wingback chairs and dark wood paneling and whatnot. And in comes the general with another member, a guy who I think is a lawyer called Elton Stoddard III, who drops the general in our laps for safekeeping while he goes off to the can or something. Soon we get to chatting, and when Tony Cannelloni goes over to say hi to some other mook, the general reveals that he is only a guest, but he has been invited to the big to-do up at the camp next week, and he very much wants to be a full Bohemian, but he can't find an angle. So we talk about this and that, and he realizes that I am no little connected in the San Francisco community. So he appeals to my expertise. I need to bring something to the club they cannot otherwise procure, he says. And this leads to that, and up comes the plan to bring the regular Bettys, and he hires me to do the dirty work, which I accept with vigor, as I need a fresh pull with the Bohemians, as they can be a very large source of filthy lucre for those of us in the entertainment business.
And so you turn this task over to me, why? I asked.
Because you are connected on the street, said Sale.
But I am only here for a couple of years, while you...
I married a long time, and I'm no longer conversant in the world of single dames, said Sale.
By which he meant no one liked him, and except for Tony Cannelloni, Ronnie Biscotti, and a few other Knights of Columbus not nicknamed after desserts, no one in the city would so much as slap Sal to get a bug off their hand, let alone do him a favor, as he had used up much goodwill in the pursuit of profit. I don't know, Sal, I said. I do not think that I am your guy.
No. You're my guy, Two Toes, said Sal, because I am not a war hero like you.
And here's something between anger and ice ran up my spine, for only Sal and very few others knew that I was no war hero. And he used the Two Toes moniker to make this crystal to me. Sal, I said, why do we not just...
Do not for a second think that you can just get some girls from Madame Mabel's on post and dress them up like Bettys from next door because the general is no sap.
Sal always said Madame Mabel with her title, like she was a doctor or a senator, or had received an advanced degree in salami concealment from a respected college of floozy management.
Make this happen, Sammy, or a little bird may tell the cops a story about a guy he knows who is going by an assumed name, a guy who clocked a cop and walked while being transported to a work detail for multiple drunken disorderlies. Am I clear, Two Toes?
In my defense, that was the last D&D I received. I'd lost my ID, and I never gave them my real name, so... While I may indeed have accidentally knocked out a cop and walked away from a work crew, they never knew who they were looking for. Of course, there are fingerprints and a John Doe mugshot on file down at the county somewhere, but the guy in that picture is various shades of bruised and bleeding, due to three displeased, recently discharged Marines, who I suggested
had especially close relationships with their mothers. That picture probably doesn't even look like me. Anyway, Sal set me up with a new name, an ID, and a job, where he pays me less than the going rate because I owe him. When I took the deal, I never knew how much and how long I'd owe him. "Clear," I said to Sal. "I will figure it out, boss." I just needed him to go, get out of there, in case Stilton came in while he was going on about the war hero thing. Even if I was building nothing into something, pulling another Molly Warner made-up romance, even if I never saw her again. I didn't want to see her right then, with the war hero thing in the air. Then the front door opened behind me, and a shadow of weaselly caution fell over Sal's face. Over my shoulder, I saw Pookie O'Hara filling the doorway. 260 pounds of crooked cop, in a rumpled suit that looked like it had had enough food wiped on it that if you boiled it for soup, a poor family could eat for a week on it. "Hey, officer," I threw to Pookie, but he just growled and made a show out of moving a bar stool back far enough to get his big belly up to the bar. Normally, he would remind me that he's a detective inspector and not a mere officer, but he was about to strong-arm a free drink, and since Eddie Mooshoes once accidentally mentioned that I keep a glass behind the bar in which I have rubbed a dead rat just for special occasions, which is entirely untrue, but highly effective at assuring civility in certain citizens, Pookie let it go. I could tell this steamed his clams no little, which is exactly what I was going for. I didn't want Pookie camping at my bar, and that vain pink potato of a nose showed he did more than a little bar camping. Now Sal was in no mood to stay. Something was going on with Pookie. "Give my best to the missus," I said, giving Sal the out that he was looking for, and it worked.
"I sure will, kid," he said. "Hansie's expecting me. I gotta go."
Then under his breath,
"Not a word to anyone about that other thing, right?"
"Right," I said with a wink. "Dog pizza." Clearly, whatever angle he was playing with the general and the Bohemians, he did not want Pookie O'Hara to be a party to it. He avoided looking at the big cop and headed out through the back. Pookie tried to call him back before I had a chance to ask the cop his poison. The front door opened again and sunlight blasted a smoky arc through the saloon, causing patrons to grab their hats for protection. When the door squeaked shut again and the light abated, the cheese was sliding onto the stool at the end of the bar like a weary angel. Chapter 4. Dinner in North Beach. I could let Sammy tell you this part of the tale, but let's face it. When it comes to the cheese, Sammy's got all the perspective of a bucket full of dark. I've been telling the part Sammy doesn't. Don't worry about who I am. I know things. My people know things. She was wearing a little red hat with one of those net veils that reached to the tip of her nose, to be mysterious or to keep the flies out of her eyes. But certainly not for modesty, or there would have been netting at her bust line, where her bosoms were rising out of her sundress, like the waxing twin moons of Barsoom. So the cheese slid up to the bar, just around the bend from Pookie O'Hara, who ogled her wares with no discretion whatsoever, as if working as a vice cop, someone gave him license to view all dames as merchandise. Or perhaps he was just a low-brow mug who wouldn't know how to treat a member of the gentler sex if she smacked him upside the head with a sack full of vaginas. Sammy was thinking the latter, and he made a great effort not to ogle her himself, out of respect.
"Hey, handsome," she said to Sammy. "Can I get a bourbon and ginger ale?"
"One of those for me, too, rocks, hold the ginger," said Pookie.
He leaned in to Stilton.
"A little early for a dame to be in a place like this on her own, ain't it, Toots?"
"I'm not on my own. I'm here visiting my boyfriend, Johnny."
"Sammy," Sammy said. He set the drinks down in front of them, gave hers a swizzle. Wished he really had a dead rat glass for him.
"Sammy," repeated the cheese.
A wink to Sammy over a dainty sip of her drink. Sammy didn't want to, but he guessed he had to introduce them. "Officer O'Hara, this is Mrs. Toombs," said the cheese.
"Punani Toombs."
She offered her fingertips for a shake or a kiss. Sammy couldn't be sure.
"Charmed, I'm sure."
"Punani?" asked the big cop.
"Father was Hawaiian. Pet name he had for my mother. No idea what it means, a type of orchid, I think."
Pookie choked on his drink. Sammy turned to the back bar and pretended to do inventory to hide his grin.
"Hey, Tiffin," said Pookie. "What was Sal's hurry getting out of here?"
"Tiffin," said the cheese. "I thought you were Italian."
"Long story, pumpkin," said Sammy. "Not in front of the nice policeman."
"I feel like I don't even know you anymore," said the cheese, putting on a pout.
"Hey," said Pookie. "I don't like a guy makes for the exits as soon as I come in. It ain't polite."
"Sal got a call from the missus right before you came in," Sammy said to the cop. "Dames, what are you going to do?"
"You sure he isn't trying to put some action together?"
"Tax-free?"
asked Pookie, pushing his hat back on his head. "He knows he's got to always pay his taxes, don't he?"
Sammy couldn't even fathom how Pookie already knew that Sal was thinking about getting into the business of recruiting dames for entertainment purposes. It was well known that Pookie O'Hara exacted a tail tax for any and all transactions in the north end of the city.
"I pour drinks, officer."
"I know how Sal wants me to pour drinks. He wants me to pour yours for free. That's what I know."
"Kid, I ain't paid for a drink in this town in 20 years. That's just due, not a favor."
"That's what I know," Sammy said, a shrug.
"Well, I got some contacts down to the Bohemians, and they think that Sal might be arranging something for them."
Of course, Pookie had contacts at the Bohemian Club. Sammy had heard the story at Cookie's Coffee. Before the war, O'Hara had walked a beat in the Tenderloin. It was a big deal because he walked the beat alone with a nightstick in hand. He'd been an institution of sorts. The Bohemian Club's city digs were at Taylor and Post Streets, right in the heart of the Tenderloin. No way he hadn't had dealings with them. The cop downed his cocktail like it was a shot. Ice jumped in the glass when it hit the bar. He reached into his pocket and flipped a silver dollar on the counter.
"I'll see you, kid. And don't put it in the till. I drink for free, but that don't mean you don't get paid."
A dollar was a damn good tip on one drink, and Sammy was skeptical. Pookie O'Hara's reputation preceded him, and it was all stick, no carrot.
"Tell the gentleman thanks," said Stilton.
Pookie tipped his hat to Stilton, nodded to Sammy.
"You let me know how Sal keeps up with his taxes, then," he said.
So there it was. Pookie thought he had just bought Sammy for a buck. They watched Pookie drag himself off the seat with a groan. He was ambling toward the door when it opened, and in a split second the sunlight was eclipsed by a black fellow, about 23 feet tall, and half again as wide, wearing a tux and tails. Now Pookie was quite unused to encountering someone larger than himself, and it was well known that before the war he made it his personal mission to keep the north end of the city free from people of the colored persuasion by administering many threats and beatings. So he pulled up, and, somewhat nonplussed, said,
"Hey, Buck, I think you're in the wrong place. They don't serve coloreds here."
Sammy froze behind the bar. The cheese's eyes were darting back and forth from the door to Sammy, like she was watching a ping-pong match.
"Well, that's okay," said the big man in the tux, gentle as a lullaby, "'cause I ain't colored."
Sammy slowly backed over to where his cane was leaning, then stopped himself. "He's doing some work for me, Inspector," he said.
"Yeah?"
asked Pookie.
"Yeah,"
said Sammy. Stilton nodded slowly at the flatfoot, as serious as St. Joan lighting a cigar to confirm the tale. This gave Pookie an out, which he needed, unless he wanted to pull his gat and start blasting, because he no longer carried the nightstick that shored up his reputation when he walked the Tenderloin pre-war, and the small pocket sap he carried now wouldn't get him far with the giant in the tux.
"Well, you watch yourself, boy," he said to the big man, then did an awkward sideways shuffle to get through the door.
When the door eased closed and the saloon returned to smoky twilight, the big man was sitting at the bar in Pookie's vacated seat, just around the corner from Stilton. Everyone in the joint was looking at him. "At ease," Sammy called to the day drunks, and they went about their business. Then to the big man. "Hey, Lone."
"Hey, Sammy,"
said the big man, his voice a bass fiddle drawl sounding out of a mine shaft.
"What can I get you?"
"Just a Coca-Cola," said the big man. "I'm about to start my shift."
Sammy caught Stilton nodding at the big man, then at a glass, then throwing up an eyebrow as if to say, "Introduce me, you blockhead." Too late. To the big man, the cheese said,
"You work around here?"
Lone looked a bit startled at the question, but smiled.
I work the door down to the Moonlight on Broadway. They a jazz club.
I know it, said Stilton, dazzling a smile that would have put a figure skater or a racehorse receiving roses to shame.
Lone, said Sammy.
This is Stilton. Stilton, this is Lone Jones.
Charmed, Lone, said Stilton, offering her hand.
Lone looked panicked for a second, then took the tips of her fingers and gave them a gentle shake.
Lonius, said Lone, short for Thelonius.
I thought Theo was short for Thelonius.
No, ma'am. Not for me, it ain't. Mama called me Lonius 'cause wouldn't nobody play with me when I was little.
Lone's mother lives with him here in the city, Sammy said.
We rents us a little place over to the Fillmore. Mama put up them calico curtains she like. Grow some flowers and boxes in the window. Cute as a bug's ear. We lived over to Hunter's Point till Sammy got me the job over to the Moonlight. But it's just temporary until I get in the Secret Service.
Hey, 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 said Sammy like he was reining in a runaway horse. Secret, Lone. Secret.
Oh, yeah, said Lone. I forgot. Sorry, ma'am, I ain't supposed to talk about it.
Well, just the same, a pleasure meeting you, said the cheese. Then to Sammy, who was fidgeting in place because he wanted to check on his customers, but didn't want to leave Stilton there with Lone, she said, You'll be here until 2?
Sammy nodded, stomach flopping, his heart on a roller coaster.
I'll see you later, then, she said, a slow and sultry wink on the U. With a smile at Lone, she waved toodles to the two and was out the door with a swish of her skirt. You could get a full meal and a glass of red wine for a buck and a quarter at any of the family-style Italian restaurants in North Beach. But the cheese liked Vanessi's on Broadway, because there was a counter by the open kitchen, where the cooks looked out for her when she was on her own. She was one of the restaurant tribe, even if she'd only been dealing breakfasts off her arm at the Five and Dime for 18 months. Of course she had to put up with the cooks getting fresh, but they kept it pretty tame, but with actual families eating at tables nearby. A couple of guys, business types, sat down at the counter, but before they could slide down to pitch woo at her, Vinny, a ham-fisted ox of a cook, plopped down a water glass full of Chianti in front of Stilton as he cast a threatening glance at the business guys and said, Here you go, sis. He might as well have set down a glass of diphtheria, for the way the two mugs were suddenly trying to pay attention to anything, anywhere else, but Stilton's end of the counter.
Thanks, Vin, said the cheese.
New hat?
Asked Myrtle as she scissor-stepped her way into the seat next to Stilton. She was a rangy redhead with lots of legs and quite a little gawkiness. She still wore a pink waitress uniform from the Five and Dime, the apron rolled up and stashed in her purse. She had put on her face and primped her hair up a little, pinning it back with a tortoiseshell comb she'd picked up in Chinatown, so she wasn't the same plain Jane that Sammy had seen through the window that afternoon.
"Well, don't you make a girl feel like a dish rag fresh from mopping sweat off a hobo," said Myrtle,
giving the cheese a once-over.
"Don't be silly, you look nice," said Stilton. "Ran late?"
"Yeah, didn't have time to go home and change. Had a couple of campers at the counter, drinking coffee and smoking. Regular, so I couldn't throw them out. I swear, sometimes I miss the war, the shortages, the blackouts."
She sighed wishfully.
"Waiting in that milky river of sailors flowing up and down Broadway in their bell-bottoms," Stilton said, teasing.
"Those were the days."
Another sigh. Myrtle, suddenly conscious that the two business guys at the other end of the counter were listening, said,
"Not that I'm a floozy or nothing, because I'm not."
"Course not," said Stilton.
"She is, though,"
Myrtle said to the business guys, who laughed.
"Am not," said the cheese.
Vinny sent a glass of Chianti down in front of Myrtle.
"These bums bothering you, though?"
"Nah," said Myrtle. "They were just doing what Tilly hoped they would do when she packed herself into that dress."
"Yeah, I didn't notice," said Vinny.
He headed back around the stainless counter to the line and pointed to the business guys. Then it was I. Then back to them again to let them know he was watching them. They made a fuss about putting on their hats and taking their business elsewhere.
"Well, there you go," said Myrtle. "Chased off another pair of perfectly good guys."
"Those guys?" said Stilton.
"Those guys are both married and looking for a reason not to go home to their wives. You could see it in their eyes. Both of them old enough to be your dad, anyway."
"Easy for you to say," said Myrtle,
gesturing from Stilton's cleavage to her smart red hat.
Why, if I had your figure, I'd marry the richest guy in San Fran, and I'd drive around in a convertible Cadillac with the top down, even when it was cold, just so I could show off my furs, and I'd smoke my cigarette in a long black holder so my lipstick didn't get messed up. I'd flip ashes on everybody as I went by, and I'd curse in French when I got stuck behind a cable car.
In French? Said Stilton.
Yeah. Cursing in French is classier. It ain't even like cursing, more like poetry.
You was my old lady, you'd be farting through silk, said Vinny, coming around the line again. What can I bring you, dolls?
Lasagna, said Stilton. Same, said Myrtle.
Them's gonna take you a few more minutes. We gotta heat them in the oven.
Yeah, said Myrtle. Maybe we'll have another glass of wine or two.
One comes with a meal, said Vinny.
Farting through silk, huh?
Ash Myrtle, a drawn on eyebrow, raising, schly-like. Vinny shrugged, causing rolls of fat to bunch up on his neck, like a stack of sausages below a chef's toque, then grabbed the bottle from under the counter and filled both of their glasses. He was married to one of the daughters of the owners, had five kids, and the only thing he ever got out of flirting was a basket full of empty Chianti bottles, but hey, he was Italian and there were expectations.
So? Said Myrtle,
dragging out the so to invite a story.
The new guy? He'll do, said Stilton. He's nice. Funny. He's cute. And you never had one come by work before, so he's got that going for him. But a bartender? There's no future in that kid.
Myrtle had seen Sammy when he came by the five and dime earlier. So had the cheese. But she'd bolted into the back and hidden, shy as a schoolgirl, before he'd seen her.
Yeah, well, I've had a future. I don't need a guy to take me away from everything. I don't need a guy at all. He'll do for now, probably.
Myrtle cringed a little and took a sip of her wine. When she wasn't cracking wise or slinging plates, Stilton carried a little sack of sorrow with her that could knock the sparkle out of her wide Lucille Ball eyes and the shine off her surprised hair.
Look, Tilly, said Myrtle, what I said about the war, I know it was harder for you. I didn't mean...
Forget about it, Stilton said, and she was about to say how Sammy would do because he seemed a little broken, and that's how she liked them. But then, being as there is no small town so small as a neighborhood in a big city, Sal Gabelli slipped onto the stool next to Myrtle.
Evening, ladies, said Sal. Hope I'm not bothering you.
He wore his overcoat over his white shirt and bow tie from the bar. Myrtle wrinkled her nose, thought she smelled vinegar on him. But it was probably just stale booze.
Hey,
said Sal, pointing at the cheese.
Didn't I?
Nope.
Wasn't me, I'm new.
Don't mind her, mister, said Myrtle. She's got one of those faces.
Right,
said Sal.
You ladies waiting for your husbands to go off work?
Here on her own,
said Myrtle.
Just a couple of used-to-be Rosies trying to get by in the big city.
She meant Rosie the Riveter, as both she and Stilton had worked the shipyards during the war. Sal threw a nod to one of the cooks, who caught his eye and recognized him.
Well, maybe I could help you with that,
said Sal.
I might have an opportunity for you gals to make a little folding cabbage, if you're interested.
We ain't floozies. Tilly, do I have a floozy sign pasted on my back? Sure, her, I can understand the mistake, but I'm wearing my waitress uniform, for Christ's sake.
No, nothing like that,
said Sal.
This is completely legit, above board, girl next door stuff. I just thought you might be able to pocket a little cheddar, if your husbands don't mind, that is.
We're single and you know it, said Stilton. Spit it out, what's the angle?
Single, gals? Well, that's just aces. How would you ladies like to spend a little time with some very rich guys? Cream of the crop, as they say, and make a little lettuce for your trouble.
Yes, said Myrtle.
Wait a minute, said the cheese. With our clothes on?
I swear I'm a virgin, just be social and look pretty,
said Sal.
Dance a little, smile a little. Think of it like you're being USO volunteers for rich guys.
Yes,
said Myrtle. Not so fast, said the cheese.
What kind of money are we talking? $50.
Said Sal.
Yes, said Myrtle.
$50 was more than a week's pay at the five and dime. Each, said Stilton.
Each, said Sal.
Yes, said Myrtle. Let's go. There will be food, right?
I can't, said Stilton. I have something to do tonight.
I don't, said Myrtle. Don't worry about the food I've eaten before. It ain't strictly necessary.
Sal took his hat off, revealing his stripy comb-over.
No, no, you misunderstand me. I'm just setting us up for the end of the week. You ladies can take all the time you need. In fact, let me get your dinners for you.
$75, said Stilton.
Wait, what?
Each, said Stilton. Myrtle grabbed her arm like she was digging for a vein.
Wait a minute.
Look, you want us to block out our calendar a week in advance. We need to know it's worth our time.
Look, this is a very generous offer, sister. Most single girls would pay that much just to get in the same room with these guys.
$100, said Stilton.
Holy shit, lady, said Sam. Who do you think you are?
Yeah, lady, who do you think you are? Said Myrtle.
She downed her cheap red in a gulp and proceeded to stare at Stilton, as if she could weld her insane lips together with a gaze.
$75,
said Sal.
What?
Said Myrtle.
I thought you liked dancing.
See not or nothing, Stilton said.
Fine, said Sal. But you gotta bring 8, maybe 10 friends with you, all lookers, too, if you can manage.
That's a tall order, said the cheese.
She don't have 10 friends, whispered Myrtle.
I'll do what you can, said Sal. I got a backup angle. Let me get your number. I'll call you with the when and where in the meantime. Except for the girls you recruit, keep this on a QT. These are some very important guys. They like their privacy.
Give me a number, Myrtle, said the cheese. Then to Sal.
I got no phone. Disturbs my beauty sleep.
Then to Vinny.
Vinny, can we get a couple more glasses of red? The gentleman is buying.
Chapter 5. Dames, they come and go. 2 hours before closing, Stilton showed up again, looking somewhat more wobbly than when she'd left. Her red hat was a little cockeyed, and she turned the veil back on itself so it looked like a big red eyebrow across her forehead. Sammy mixed the bourbon and ginger and placed it in front of her. You bugged out of here pretty fast earlier. Something scare you off?
No, the colored fellow was okay, but that cop gave me the creeps. Like he was suspicious of me or something.
Sammy looked at her, just looked at her. Raised an eyebrow. Punani Tunes?
People always think that Stilton is weird.
Yeah, smart to avoid that. Well, he's as dim as a 3-watt bulb, ain't he? If you're planning a caper, that's the flat foot you want flapping after you. That mug couldn't catch a cough in a tire fire. Almost makes you want to go commit some crimes, just 'cause you know you could get away with it. What about you, Hopalong? You want to go perpetrate some crimes with me? Gotta finish my shift, but I'll take a rain check on that, Toots.
Don't call me Toots.
Hopalong? The eyebrow.
Fair enough, Toots it is. Let's drink to our future crimes.
She took a pull on her drink until it made a delicate slurping noise. A straw at the bottom of the glass, like a tiny parched elephant. She slid the empty glass to him. As Sammy refreshed the drink, he realized he really liked this broad. Really, really liked her. He wasn't love yet, so he might still escape. But he didn't remember ever liking anyone quite as much as he found himself liking this broad. And with that, he smiled like a dog at a barbecue for the blind. He set the drink down in front of her. She picked up the glass and paused.
You're not gonna make a girl drink alone, are you, soldier?
He liked her enough to feel like he should really tell her that he wasn't a soldier. Had never been. But he liked her enough to not want her to go away. Not right now. I guess not. He poured himself a double and checked his watch. 2 hours until closing. To our crimes, he said. Raising his glass to toast.
Crimes, said the cheese,
having a little trouble aiming her glass at his until the third try, when she managed to clink glasses.
Holy moly, I might need you to walk me home.
I might be able to do that, said Sammy,
but I don't like to talk about the war.
Don't worry, pal,
said the cheese.
That's not going to be a problem.
A cop was softly burbling the cleavage of a big blonde in the corner, holding his hat in his hand behind his back out of respect. The gentlemen scattered about the parlor were distracted from their own comely diversions, all draped in lingerie and painted just so.
Best take him in the back,
said Mabel, the madam, The uniform makes the guests nervous.
Bess cracked her gum and salute and pulled the cop by his tie through velvet curtains.
"I run a tight ship,"
said Sally Gabb. He was a head shorter than the madam. Mabel packed into a green satin evening gown with her crimson hair spraying high, and then splashing down over her shoulders looked like a tube of red paint. Someone had squeezed hard in the middle. Standing next to her, Sal Gabelli, in his ill-fitting suit, looked like a black-and-white character that had stumbled into a Technicolor movie, like there was just not enough color and life in the joint for the both of them. He was carrying a camera, one of those small German jobs down by his side, like he was sneaking a pistol into a bank.
"Pictures are gonna cost you extra, Sally," Mabel said. "You hand me the film, and I give you back when I see fit. No faces. I get a guy, does the developing and printing. That's not my game, Mabel, so I need a dame."
"Color me surprised," said Mabel. She fitted a cigarette into a long ivory holder and waited for him to light it for her.
"No luck at the hardware store and the barber shop, then. Thought you'd take a shot in the dark and stop into my joint?"
She smiled, a little lipstick there and a front tooth, and blew smoke over his head.
"Why you busting my balls, Mabes? I'm trying to do business here. I need a specific kind of dame."
"Once again, you've come to the right place, Sal. I happen to have specific kinds of dames.
What specifics were you looking for, specifically?" "I need a looker. But you can't look too much like a floozy. No offense."
Madam clamped her back teeth down on a cigarette holder like a mug chomping a cigar.
"Go on. So let's be able to pull off the girl next door thing. Give up the goods in the end, but not make it too easy, you know? Act interested in the guy even if she thinks he's a toad. Like a real dame.
Pretend to be a real dame, check.
She's gotta be smart and a little sneaky. She's gonna be the one working the camera, but she has to do it on the QT. These guys can't know she's doing it.
So you're not just looking to get your ashes hauled, am I right?"
"No, not for me. I'm working an angle."
"Not with one of my girls, you aren't. My girl's my angle." Mabel turned and walked over to the bar, forcing Sal to follow her, stand in the middle of the room, holding his camera like a goof. He hurried after her.
"I put together a bevy of broads at Bohemian Club for the annual cookout or whatever up in that Redwood Grove they have in Sonoma County."
"Scotch and soda," Mabel said to the bartender. "Vinegar and water for Sal here."
"Hey,"
said Sal, waving off the bartender.
"Something like that. This could be worth some serious cabbage."
Mabel took the drink from the bartender, sipped a bit through a straw, then wheeled on Sal, causing him to lean back like he was about to be snake-bit.
"Look, Sal, I got a good business here, but it only runs at the pleasure of the powers that be, from the mayor to the cops. Some of the city supervisors are my best customers, so I got connections. Connections I use, and connections I need. But the Bohemians, that's a whole different level of juice. Those guys got power that runs countries. They eat mugs like Pookie O'Hara and the mayor for breakfast. Presidents, princes, scientists, artists, Nobel Prize mugs, the whole kit and caboodle. They say they hatch the atom bomb up at their little cookout. You do not fuck with guys like that. And from time to time, they throw a little business my way, and they pay extra for discretion, which they don't have to, because if I don't have discretion, my business caves like an accordion. So tell me, Sal, why would I want or need you to pimp one of my girls to them? And before you answer, Pookie O'Hara came by yesterday to pick up his fee, and he made it clear that if you showed up looking to do anything but get laid, I was to let him know. So I got your discretion dangling, Buster."
She handed a cigarette holder to the bartender, who removed the butt, stubbed it out in the ashtray, and returned the holder to her, reloaded. She waited while Sal fidgeted.
"Can I get a seltzer rocks?"
Sal said to the bartender. Then to Mabel.
"This ain't about peddling tale, and you know it. I got a guy who wants in the Bohemians. Wants him bad, but he can't find an angle. So he wants normal baddies, shop girls and secretaries and whatnot, which I can find. I think I can find. Anyway, he's paying a pretty penny over what the girls get, but I'd be willing to give all that lettuce to you. And you're in the wind, clean as a whistle. I'll work my angle from there."
"Lynch's blackmail?"
Mabel smiled.
Well, you heard what they get up to? Guys dressing up like broads. Secret rituals, naked dancing, singing show tunes. And that's before they get rolling with the booze and the broads. I ran booze for those mugs during Prohibition, and they can put some away. And figure the right shot of the president of Lisbon, dressed like Garbo while a dame yanks his crank, could be worth some serious cabbage.
Lisbon is a city, you dope, not a country. She teed up her cigarette holder and waited, while Sal dug his Zippo out of his pants and lit it for her. Mabel leaned back, elbows against the bar. She blew smoke out into the room.
I will not be a player in blackmail, Sal. Ah, come on, Mabel.
But she didn't look at him, just scanned the room as she spoke, looking out for business.
I have been known to make recommendations, arrange talent for someone who's perpetrating such a heinous crime. That's all I'm looking for. What kind of talent for you are you talking about? 2 G's.
Mabel let the ash fall off her cigarette into the carpet, but did not look at Sal.
For one girl? For one night? 2 grand? Plus a few expenses. I might need a few more dames for a fill-in. In case my guy doesn't come through, nothing special. That's a lot of folding money for one night. And their thing goes on for a week. If the girls work out, stay longer, there's more. Well, you'll give all that up. I figure I'll get a fair stack myself, you know, for taking the risk. This blows back, Sal. Those guys will have you put in a sack and dropped in the bay, and be halfway around the world when it happens. They won't even know the guy who knows the guy who ties the sack.
That's why I'll have the pictures. Insurance.
This blows back on me, Sal. I'll have you put in a sack, and I don't give a good goddamn about the pictures. Are we clear?
So you got the right broad?
2 G's. 1 girl, 1 night. We never talked. I don't know you, and if anyone asks, you're a stranger and a douchebag. Got it?
Got it. She's got to be fresh-faced like Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz.
Come in tomorrow, lunchtime. Give me a time and the place of the girl to be. And if I need a few more dames, all scrubbed-up Bettys from down on the farm, you can do that. Give me a time, a place, and how many farm girls you need.
Thanks, Mabel, you're the best.
Get out of my place before I change my mind. And have you put in a sack on principle. And leave the camera.
There are 6 boxwood bushes neatly trimmed into bullet-shaped pillars, lining the walkway into the Victorian mansion that housed Mabel's. So when a 7th shrub, taller than the others but bullet-shaped as well, stepped out of the dark to accost Sal as he exited, he was more than somewhat startled.
"Christ on a crutch! Pookie!"
Sal exclaimed, stepping back and gathering his wits, which had scattered like a handful of loose pearls when the big top materialized.
"What the hell you doing lurking out here in the yard like a goon? I could have had a heart attack."
"Thanks, man," said Pookie O'Hara. He snatched Sal up by the front of his coat and lifted him until he stood on tiptoes. "Nobody pet his tail in my town, but they don't pay the tax, Sal. Time to pay up." Pookie pulled a leather sap out of his back pocket and pushed it up onto Sal's nose.
"You got it all wrong, Pookie. What am I, stupid? I wouldn't think of stepping on your action.
That's not what I hear from little bird down to the Bohemian Club. I hear he's setting up something for some military mucky-mutt from their camp out." He dug the leather-wrapped lead sap into Sal's cheekbone. Sal busted his lip, trying to squirm away. Pookie shook him like he was a dish rag and popped him lightly on the forehead with sap. The blackjack had barely moved, but Sal could feel the blow all the way in his back teeth. A full swat with that thing would put him in the drooling ward for good.
"Oh, fuck yeah. Yeah, I was talking about it, but it wasn't me. I got nothing to do with it. I was just delivering a message."
"For who?" Again the shake.
"Two Toes. Sammy Two Toes," Sal squealed. "That guy's bad news, Pookie. Doesn't know his place. Doesn't understand the order of things."
"You're running errands for your gimpy bartender."
"Yeah. It ain't what he seems, Pookie. That guy has me over a barrel. I've been covering for him because he knows my old lady threatened to tell her about my visits here to Mabel's for services."
Sal stifled a little grin.
He was so pleased with himself for explaining his presence at Mabel's. At the same time, he was throwing the heat on Sammy.
You let a skinny gimp like that get the drop on you. That's pathetic.
Pookie loosened his grip on Sal's coat, allowing the douchebag to settle to his heels on the sidewalk.
Yeah, he's more of an operator than he looks like. When he first came to me, he told me he cold-cocked a cop and walked away from a work detail at the jail. For all I know, his name ain't even Tiffin. Check the records 2 years ago or so. Try Tuffalo. He was in on a drunken disorderly, but he knocked out a cop and ran.
Pookie let go of Sal's coat and stepped away. Sal watched the big cop's anger shifting, scanning for a place to settle like a street mutt looking for a fight.
You go after two toes for nose. You collect your due, and you teach him a lesson about clocking cops,
Sal said, gilding the lily. Pookie pocketed the blackjack, shot the lapels of his overcoat.
He at your place tonight?
Sal checked his watch.
Not anymore. Closed. But I got his home address in my book.
Sal patted his coat over the breast pocket.
Give it, Pookie said.
And Sal, I find out you're lying to me. I'll write my name on the street with your brains.
Sal shuddered, pulled the black address book from his coat pocket. Well, don't let the kid fast talk you, Pookie. Don't let him get the drop on you. He's quick for a cripple.
Yeah, don't you worry about it. Chapter 6 A Sweet Disaster. It was 2 a.m, and they were the only ones left in the joint. She was up on her knees on the bar stool, elbows on the bar, her face about 2 inches from Sammy's, who was leaning over from his side of the bar. It had been like that for half an hour, and hadn't noticed the place clearing out.
You like dogs? He asked.
Yeah, you?
Yeah, he gets swell nostrils.
Thanks, I like yours, too.
Your eyelashes are first rate.
Can you even see them?
Kind of. I memorized them from before.
You'd better walk me home now. I'll pack a lunch.
Sammy took a bottle of gin that was 3/4 full from the well and filled it to the top with Rose's lime juice, and the cheese packed it in her pocketbook for the walk home. She stumbled on a turned heel as he was locking the door, and he caught her by the waist. That's when the first kiss happened. It was the kind of kiss that he wanted to wake up to and keep refreshing periodically until he got one long last one, salty with tears in his casket. They both came out of it a little lightheaded but safe, as there was no open flame to ignite their breaths.
How far? Asked Sammy.
Not far, said the cheese.
She led him in a somewhat wobbly way down Grant Avenue a few blocks, then arms around each other up Greenwich Street, where the stairs began.
How far?
Not far.
Up the stairs of Telegraph Hill, switchback. Another set of stairs. A few steps on a path, more stairs. At 150 steps or so, Sammy leaned against the wooden rail and tried to catch his breath.
He said not far.
The cheese thought it was cute that he believed her.
Not far from here, she said.
She booped his nose and started up another flight of stairs, pulling him behind by one hand. Another 100 steps, and they were almost at the top. He sat down on the wooden stairs. Moonlight filtered through the pine trees. He threw up a little. Just a little.
Almost there, she said.
I should tell you, he said. I'm in pretty good shape. I work out every day, nearly every day. It's just, well, I've been drinking.
You can use my toothbrush when we get to my place.
Ah, you don't have to do that, he said. She was nice. She pulled him to his feet. Then up another 100 1/4 steps until they walked out into the clearing of Pioneer Park, overlooking the entire city. On a clear night, you could see Oakland, Alameda, and Berkeley across the bay. And since the war, the Bay Bridge even had lights on it. Coy Tower stood like an enormous concrete phallus above them.
You live there?
Sammy asked.
I've never been up here.
Just a little farther.
Down the other side of the hill, wooden stairs zigged and zagged back and forth, joined by paths between gardens maintained by the people who lived in houses perched on the hillside. Cozy cottages and modern deco apartment buildings. None very tall, all wound up in trees and flowers and gravity, looking out on the bay. She led him down a path through a gate and to a low door, leading into the very bottom floor of a triplex, what looked like the entrance to a storage area.
"Here we go,"
she said. He had a duck to get through the door. She flipped on a light and presented it to Diggs. The whole place was painted bright sunshine yellow, even the floor, which was plywood. It was one room, basically, with a single window in the front that looked out onto one of the hill's gardens. A bed by the wall. A sink and counter with a two-burner cooker and a small refrigerator. The motor on the top buzzing away like it might give out any second. At the end of the bed, a door was open to a bathroom. A toilet and shower pan in a plywood closet. On the wall opposite the bed was an old couch. An end table with a lamp on a doily. A coffee table with some movie magazines, and a radio with a record player in it. The floor extended only as far back as the end of the couch. Then the plywood stopped, and bedrock and hard-packed dirt, painted yellow, started to slope up with the hill. Sammy spotted something green sprouting near the couch.
"The landlord gave me a great deal," said the cheese.
"That's nice," said Sammy. "Cozy."
"Have a seat," she said,
waving to the couch.
"I'll light the burners, and then we'll get toasty in here in no time."
Sammy took off his coat and sat on the couch. She set the bottle full of gimlets on the coffee table and pulled a couple of glasses out of her pocketbook as well.
"Are those in the bar?"
"Nope," she said.
"Pour us a couple, will you?"
"That back part, that dirt?"
"Yeah, this was a crawl space. Landlord put a window in for me, so it's not bad during the day, but it was a little spooky at night, so I painted the dirt yellow."
"Yeah. Really brightens it up."
"The landlord said I could dig out a sunroom back there if I want to. I thought I was going to have to tunnel out of nursery once when my period was late."
As she was heading back to the couch, he grabbed her by the arm and pulled her down next to him.
"You're not so tough," he said. She pushed him back. "You'll find out how tough I am if you try to kiss me before brushing your teeth, Buster. There's a toothbrush and a can of Pepsodent by the sink."
He stumbled to the sink, pasted and brushed, and midway through, looked over at her with an insane toothpaste foam grin. She laughed into her drink, spilling a little down her front.
"I'll get that," he said.
He spit, rinsed, spit again, and executed a controlled fall across the room, with a giant step over the coffee table, that ended with him more or less lying in her lap, face up. The cheese managed to keep her drink intact.
"How's it going, Toots?" he said.
She kissed him lightly to test the taste.
"Minty," she said, "and don't call me Toots."
He took her drink from her, shed it on the table, then pulled a slick wrestling reverse that put her on her back on the couch, him on top, smooching the ever-loving daylights out of her. She held her own, though, reversing on him and slickly kicking off her shoes in the process. They commenced making an sound as they kissed, as if they each had discovered something delicious and needed to hum about it to the other, all the while trying to remove each other's clothing without coming up for air, until Sammy was stalled in a struggle with her bra, and she pushed him back to give him a hand.
"Doesn't look like it should be that tough," he explained,
noting with a kiss that most of her was already spilling out the top when he'd started.
"It's French," she said. "They designed it like a zoo, you know, keep them in, but give everyone a good look at them. I can't get it, help."
She rolled onto her face to give him a good shot at the hooks in the back.
"Free my people."
"I will. I am the Harriet Tubman of your breasts." She rolled back over, her people now free of their bonds.
"Well, now let me show you the Underground Railroad."
And she pushed him down until he was backing partway onto the floor, pushing the coffee table back as he went. He resurfaced under her nearly removed dress. "Hey, this doesn't look like Churchill at all. More like Rasputin."
"That's not the birthmark."
"To the left." "Oh, yeah, would you look at that?" She wove her fingers into his hair and directed his attention to the proper historical figure. And so it went. Crazy, desperate, drunken lovemaking. Wanting and having each other all at once. Building a world together. To get close enough, deep enough, fast enough. Slow enough, hard enough, soft and tender and strong and sweet, and only the two of them in it. They made their way from the couch to the rug to her little bed, where they fell away from each other, breathless for a bit, glistening with sweat. both naked now except for Sammy's one sock on his bad foot. They listened to each other, breathed for a while, staring at the ceiling. The look on both their faces of having been suddenly hit by a truck, but with fewer broken bones. She rolled out of bed and padded to her pocketbook on the floor by the couch, and he watched her go, thinking she was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen, ever would see. She took a pack of cigarettes from her purse. "You want one?" He nodded. He didn't smoke a lot, but he smoked. Everybody smoked. She lit two on the burner of her little cooker, snatched a candle from behind the sink and lit it.